friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Peters here with Mark Meckler. And Mark, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. We were just talking about, I don't know if any of you guys are suffering, but it's allergy season out there. And I'm in Texas and Rita in Virginia. Our families are experiencing the same thing. So we hope you guys are surviving spring pollen and enjoying God's beauty and bounty out there in nature. We're trying, but it's a little bit hard with the allergies.
Indeed. Well, yeah, we're going to do our best to get through without me having too many sneezes or nose blowing episodes. So here goes. Today, we're going to be talking about these pro-Hamas protests on American college campuses. And I think it's sad that we even have to discuss this. Before we get into that, we're going to give our Crossroads listeners a little tutorial on the applicable law in this area. And that's something that Mark and I were discussing yesterday. We don't think the mainstream media does a great job of helping you all understand some of the nuances of how and when the law applies. We just hear people shout, you know, First Amendment, and we think, oh, well, there's nothing we can do about any of this. But that's not quite the way it is. So we're going to talk about that. And then we want to talk about the irony that these violent protests in support of terrorism can coexist in a college culture that has increasingly turned toward coddling young adults and shielding them from any idea that they might find offensive. It's really hard for me to make sense of that dichotomy. So we're going to discuss that. But before we get into all of that, let's start by doing just a teeny bit of background on this war. It started with an October 7th raid when Hamas militants killed around 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and abducted around 250 hostages. We did a whole program discussing this situation back in the fall, and you can go back and watch that program on our podcast. But Mark, if you would just give us a brief update on your assessment of where the situation is right now with this war.
Yeah, so Israel facing an existential threat from an organization, Hamas, who has in its charter, by the way, the destruction of Israel. I mean, this is, imagine if we had in our charter the Constitution of the United States that it says that we must destroy Canada or we must destroy Mexico. It's an absolute undeniable line of hostility against Israel, against Israel's very existence. So an existential threat on their border in Gaza, saying that they're going to wipe out the Israelis. We also have footage and documentation from Hamas itself saying that they were engaged in this ceasefire with Israel, which they were before October 7th, but it was just intended to give them time to build up the weaponry, the personnel, and the plans to attack Israel on a broader scale. That got executed on October 7th. It was backed by Iran. Iran is the regional power in the area that provides all the materials and money and training to their terrorist proxies. So Iran told them, yep, go ahead and do it. The reason they did it, to add a little bit more nuance, and we believe in nuance here, the reason they did it is because there was a peace accord being negotiated between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia and Iran are mortal enemies. This is true for Iran and most of the regional Islamic states. Many of the Islamic states, a different branch of Islam there, without getting into the religious differences, but they are mortal enemies. And so Iran didn't like the idea of the Abraham Accords being extended to Saudi Arabia. They gave the go-ahead to Hamas. Since then, Israel has been systematically working its way through Gaza and destroying Hamas and their infrastructure. I want people to note, you hear the words genocide all the time. I want people to think about what it is to commit a genocide. And this is really important. One of the things that Rita and I try to do here is we have a lot of respect for those of you who listen and watch. We think you're smart people. We think you have the capability to understand nuance. We're not just going to slop news on your plate like the news media does and ask you to eat it. What we want you to do is have the facts so you can reason your way through something. Every news story, like a good meal, is made up of a bunch of different ingredients and a bunch of different flavors. And if you understand that, you can appreciate the news and make your own decisions based on what you're hearing. So I want you to understand what's going on. And first of all, what is genocide? Genocide is the intentional, complete, and total ethnic cleansing of a particular area. It's aimed at a race of people, and it's intended to wipe out the race of people. And this is true of any genocide. And there have been genocides in human history. Of course, the Nazis against the Jews is one of the most well-known, but there was an Armenian genocide in modern history. That's the intent of a genocide. And so let's compare that to what's going on in Gaza right now. In Gaza, what you have is the Israelis going into Gaza systematically on the ground, working their way through house by house, removing terrorists and terrorist sympathizers, removing the infrastructure and removing the weaponry. Now, Rita, if Israel wanted to conduct a genocide in Gaza, they have complete and total air superiority. There's literally, it would take zero casualties on the Israeli side. They could come in and they could bomb that place into the Stone Age. And they've chosen not to do that because the Israelis are being more careful than any army literally in the history of the world to do everything they possibly can to avoid civilian casualties. Are there civilian casualties? Of course there are, because we're talking about a war, and Hamas uses civilians as shields. They literally kill them if they try to leave, prevent them from leaving, blockade roads, and they have a different view in particular in Gaza, having been there generationally now as quote-unquote refugees. Some of them are fine with having their children killed and used as human shields. And so this is what the Israelis are facing. They've lost almost 300 on the ground IDF soldiers in the fighting because they choose to not use air superiority, which would require much more indiscriminate killing. They're going house to house. By the way, a full third roughly of IDF soldiers that have died in the fighting have been killed in friendly fire. This is a horrifyingly tragic thing, but this is the truth about on the ground, hand-to-hand kind of combat in urban areas. It's very difficult to discern the hostiles from the friendlies. You're doing some of this from the air. And so you end up with a lot of friendly fire deaths, and it's about a third. So close to 300 killed, probably close to 100, maybe 75 killed by friendly fire. Most of Gaza has been cleared. Ramallah is the last place that needs to be cleared. It's estimated that there are somewhere between 2 and 4 brigades. So these are huge military units in Ramallah waiting to face off against the Israelis. And the Israelis must finish off Hamas. It's an existential threat. They've been slowed down by international opinion, specifically by the U.S. pressure on them, the Biden administration's pressure on them not to go into Ramallah. They're going to have to go into Ramallah to finish this thing. So that's where we are right now. I expect them to go into Ramallah any day, literally, to finish what they began and to completely defenestrate Hamas. That's where we're at on the ground right now.
Yeah, so here you have, as you've just described it really well, Mark, on the one hand, you have Israel demonstrating great restraint in how they're responding to this existential threat because they care about preserving human life. On the other hand, you have Hamas, from what I understand, very intentionally targeting and killing civilians because they do not care about preserving human life. So to me, when I see this situation, you couldn't get a much clearer example of a war where there's a good guy and a bad guy. It's pretty clear to me which is which. And yet, what we're hearing about in the news right now, almost as much as we're hearing about coverage of the war itself, we're hearing about these demonstrations of, and I have to say it, entitled American students on American college campuses. And what's important to understand here is that they're not just protesting with their words, you know, peaceful demonstration, that's one thing. That's not largely what we're talking about here today. We're talking about these students who are pitching tents and making encampments at Columbia University, Harvard, University of Texas, University of Michigan, Southern California. There's a whole list of all of the universities where this is happening. And what's going on with these protests is not peaceful. We're talking about Jewish students being punched in the face, one being stabbed in the eye. A group of students ran over a security guard, put the security guard in the hospital and out of work. They're breaking windows. These are rioters wearing masks and blocking rights of way so that students who want to just go to their classes can't even get there without having to face this violent protest. Mark, does that sum up the situation fairly well?
Well, you make it sound really bad. And the only thing I can say is it's actually even worse than that, because what they're professing are terrorist sympathies. And these demonstrations are actually funded by organizations that are sympathetic to Hamas. The students are actually wearing the headbands of Hamas. It's important that we remember, we contextualize this. Hamas on October 7th broke through the security fence into Israel, put babies in ovens, raped women. When I say raped women, I don't want to be too graphic, but it's hard not to be, raped women to death. I literally raped them until they died. Filmed all this stuff, killed old people, took hostages. They filmed it all and live streamed it on the internet. And so now you'll hear people saying, oh, well, Hamas didn't do anything that bad. That's all propaganda. No, these guys were promoting it. There's video of them saying, you know, to their moms and dads, you'll be so proud of me. I've killed 10 of them with my own hands. And so these are the people that these entitled, spoiled, dumb college students, they're smart in that they have brain power. They got into these major universities, but they're dumb. They're uneducated. They don't understand what's going on in the world. Or look, this is the only alternative, Rita, or they're just evil. I mean, they're evil because they actually know what's going on and they're siding with evil. I think mostly they're ignorant. They don't actually know what's going on. We've seen interviews of some of these students on campus and they're asked by people, hey, why are you here? What are you protesting against? And they say, well, we don't know. And they look at their friends like, hey, what are we doing here? We just heard people were here and we came out to support them. So I think there's that going on. But we also know that there are national and international organizations that are supporting this. There's a lot of the funding for this comes from George Soros funded and related organizations. You look at the tents on these campuses, you'll see dozens and dozens of the exact same tent. It's not that these kids had these tents in their dorm rooms. Probably most of them never been camping in their lives. They couldn't take roughing it, right? And being without their Starbucks. But these are being provided by outside organizations that are spending the money for it. And they are intentionally fomenting unrest in American society. Look, by the way, I don't think this is any coincidence. Look at the timing. The last time we had open rioting and violence in our streets was our last election, right? So it's in 2020, it's the George Floyd riots all around the country. By the way, a bunch of the funding for those riots provided by the same people that are providing funding for these riots and this terrorism.
Hmm. Yeah. And so we want to get into a little bit now of the First Amendment and how it applies here, because of course, what these violent protesters will say is that, oh, the First Amendment, you know, First Amendment protects what we're doing. This is just our exercise of First Amendment rights. So we want to get pretty clear about this. The First Amendment protects student speech, as with anyone else's speech, against government interference. So we're going to talk about that distinction, who the First Amendment applies to, in just a minute. But the First Amendment protects expression, right? It doesn't protect camping. It doesn't say you can camp out wherever you want for however long you want. It doesn't protect violence. It doesn't protect blocking other people from accessing a building that they have a right to go into. So there is an important distinction to be made between peaceful expression, that is expressing an idea, even an idea that we would find repugnant, like what we're talking about now. Yes, the First Amendment does and should protect viewpoints that we don't like, but it does not protect this violence and the kind of thing that's going on now. And then, Mark, I'd like for you to just talk a little bit about the distinction that we have to make between private colleges and public colleges.
Yeah, look, we're dealing with a lot of different schools here who have different status vis-a-vis the government. Some are private institutions, and it's important to remember, generally speaking, the First Amendment does not apply to them. These are not government entities that are restricting free speech. These are private entities restricting free speech. And we saw this recently. in regard to Google. Google had a bunch of employees that were pro-Palestinian, pro-terrorist employees. They occupied an executive's office, some executive suites at two of Google's campuses, and Google kicked them out and summarily fired them. And they fired them for violating Google's policies, right? They disrupted the work environment. They were threatening a whole bunch of different things. Those people were summarily terminated, and that's appropriate. And there will be no lawsuits that lie about free speech in those because that's a private environment. So if you think of that and you think of these colleges, the same is true. Each of these colleges, whether public or private, has codes of conduct. And the students, every student who goes to one of these, I know, Rita, you've got a bunch of students at university right now, a bunch of kids in your family. They had to sign a code of conduct when they were their orientation. And it said some basic things on all of them. I won't violate the law. I won't harm anybody else. I won't threaten anybody else. They're all common in regard to simple things, common sense, good human things like that. And these kids are violating those codes of conduct. So on a private campus where there's no First Amendment protection per se, the university can remove them for anything. They can have standard time, place, manner restrictions, and they could be very restrictive, and they can remove students. They can stop students from speaking under very broad circumstances. At public institutions, say UCLA or NYU, look, those are government entities. And so the restrictions on what a university can stop a student from doing are much more limited. They have absolute, I shouldn't say absolute, but they have First Amendment protections. They still have to follow the student codes of conduct, but they have First Amendment protection that is much more broad. But there's an interesting nuance here, Rita. I don't know if you want to go into this. There's something called Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, and it protects students on campus from being harassed. And so there's some area of conflict or gray area here where that comes into conflict potentially with the First Amendment.
Yeah. So at a public university, so even at a public university where the First Amendment does fully apply, even a public university can impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions is what they're referred to in First Amendment law, as long as those are viewpoint neutral. So the big no-no with the First Amendment is you can't have a government entity like a public university saying, well, we'll allow a pro-Israel demonstration, but not a pro-Hamas demonstration. Cannot do that. But they can absolutely say, well, you can't protest right outside this classroom while the class is going on. Or they can say, you can't block the sidewalk, because those have nothing to do with either the content or the viewpoint of the speech. Those are just regulations designed to make sure that the college can fulfill its purpose in educating the students who are paying to be there for education. And then, yeah, the Title VI is a really important consideration too, Mark. And I will add that Title VI does have some application even to private universities if they are receiving any sort of federal funding. And that would include like federal student loan money, any sort of federal student aid. And Title VI does require those organizations to provide an educational atmosphere that's free from harassment on the basis of race, color, or national origin. And Mark, I don't know what you've heard, but I am hearing lots of examples of Jewish students really being harassed as part of these protests. Is that what you're hearing as well?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of video of it. I was watching video yesterday from UCLA and Jewish students trying to go to class and being prevented, physically blocked from going to class by students wearing masks and Palestinian garb, what are called keffiyehs, which are these Palestinian scarves, and really just serious harassment. There's a sort of funny one from Columbia. Columbia put out a list of things that their students needed, the students who were holding these campus areas hostage, so to speak, who had taken over. And they said they didn't want any bagels when people sent in food. Like, not anti-Semitic at all, right? Bagels aren't even from Israel. They're from Eastern European Jews invented the bagel. But I mean, just so it is intentional racial harassment, and racial harassment specifically, any discrimination on the basis of race or religion or ethnicity or gender is prohibited by Title VI. So these schools are in violation of Title VI if they're allowing this to happen. And it's up to the Biden administration. The Biden administration Department of Education could immediately rescind funding to all of these universities. It goes even deeper than what you described. It goes into research grants and things like that. And they've acknowledged they could do that. They're not doing that. They should do that. That's a tool the federal government should use to stop this on-campus harassment.
Yeah, let's go into that for a minute, Mark. Do you think that by and large, the college administrators are doing the right things? Are they addressing this the right way? Are they messaging to their students the right way? And are they enforcing their policies the way they should? What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, I think it varies from campus to campus. And interestingly, it varies politically. So when you look at the blue states or even some blue cities in red states, mostly in the blue states, these things are spiraling out of control. The administrators are allowing them to happen. If they say anything against them, they're very weak sauce that they're saying against them. You know, kind of like, we think it's good that they're expressing themselves. We hope they remain peaceful. Or they're negotiating, quote unquote, with them after these people have taken control over parts of campus and are threatening and harassing other people. So I think they're doing an incredibly poor job in the blue states. And there's a reason for that. These administrators are actually playing what I would call an inside-outside game. They believe in the same things that these demonstrators believe, these what I would call terrorists believe. So they really don't want to shut down these protests because they are brothers and sisters in philosophical alignment with these protests. But they understand that they have to say something. And so they make these weak statements. Now, if you look at what happened in Florida, they're not tolerating this. If you look at what happened in Georgia, they're not tolerating this. In Tennessee, not tolerating this. At University of Texas at Austin, near where I live, not tolerating this. And so these protests, these terrorist events don't get as out of control as they do at places like UCLA. And even UCLA last night, by the way, as we're recording this, the police went in and forced, shut down the encampment. It had become very violent. They had barricaded themselves in. So I think it is a regional difference based on politics and ideology, I have to say.
And do you think, so in places like California or wherever the police actually do go in and shut down the encampments and sort of disband everyone, do you think any criminal charges will be pressed upon the students there? Or do you think they're just going to get a slap on the wrist?
Well, I think what we're seeing all over, and this is in blue states as well as red, is criminal charges get pressed. At least on the core group or the people who are unlucky enough to get caught in those places, the criminal charges get pressed. And then what you have is radical leftist DAs in a lot of these places. This includes, by the way, in Austin, Texas, a good red state, but a blue city in a red state. And what happens is the charges get brought and then the DAs drop all the charges. And that happened here in Texas with the protesters that got removed from University of Texas, Austin. I expect to see the same thing in UCLA. There were many arrests. I expect the radical DAs in Los Angeles to drop those charges. The same is true with Columbia in New York City. New York City, full radical Soros DAs. I expect that those charges will be dropped. I don't think there will even be a slap on the wrist. I think they just went to jail. Those kids will be back on campus. The campuses themselves say that they're expelling those kids. I believe they will be expelled for about 5 minutes, and they'll be back on campus and emboldened. They'll be heroes among their peers for having been arrested by the man.
Yeah, that's really terrible. And I want to talk too about what I think is the elephant in the room, at least for that's the way I see it. And it's what I mentioned at the beginning. It's the irony of these colleges that appear to want to coddle students. There's no other word that captures it. We want to coddle students, mostly when it comes to sexual orientation, transgenderism, protecting students from hearing any ideas that are associated with traditional fundamental Christianity, any ideas that a student might consider offensive. The colleges seem to want to do anything they can to protect students from those offensive ideas, you know, and we're talking about these safe spaces in college student unions, you know, places where someone can go if they heard something that offended them, you know, bringing in dogs. And I love dogs, but bringing in dogs for students to pet when they're, you know, feeling upset about an idea that they heard that rubbed them the wrong way. And I've seen a lot of this, Mark, because as you mentioned, I have a gaggle of college students and have recently been doing a lot of college tours. And on the college tours, they're so proud of showing this off. Like, it's a big draw for the students to have all these safe spaces. So how is it that we have that atmosphere on the campus, and yet we have these violent student protests going on with students just being outright bullies to other students, and somehow that's seen as being okay? Can you help us make sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, I know on the surface that seems ironic and a contradiction, but I actually think it's perfectly cohesive as an ideology. What we're witnessing is the full-blown flowering of totalitarianism on college campuses. We've seen this throughout history. This is the way actual revolutions, violent revolutions, begin. It's very rare, almost unheard of, that violent revolutions happen without help from the elites. And what you end up with is a sort of ruling elite class that is bored and are living meaningless lives. And I put most of the responsibility on this on the parents of these kids. Rita, as you raised your kids, you gave them a charge. You told them what they were to do and what they were to be in life. And I don't mean that like go be an engineer or a doctor or whatever. I mean, you said go out and live a righteous life, live the life that Christ intended for you. Try to live that life as best as you can. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. You taught them the Ten Commandments and a righteous way of living and gave them purpose. And a lot of these kids that are at these colleges, I would say the majority of the kids, were given no purpose by their parents. They grew up on video games, on streaming Netflix, and their purpose, as suggested by their parents, is go off to college and find yourself. And there's nothing more hedonistic and self-serving, nihilistic than find yourself. If you want to find yourself, look to God. That's where you'll find yourself. Other than that, you're just going to find essentially sin and the devil. And that's what these kids have done. And so in the university, then, this is very important for folks to understand. If you haven't sent your kids to these places yet, I'm saying don't. What they're going to find is nihilism, hedonism, I would say straight up Satanism. And these kids are falling into that. And the reason that they're so aggressive and so violent about it is because what they're taught is any other way is evil. This is totalitarianism, that you have to shut down free speech of those who disagree with you. And the reason they have to do this, Rita, is because if kids actually listen to the truth will make sense to them. And they'll lose a lot of these kids to the truth. I spoke 2 weeks ago at UC Berkeley, and a lot of people will gasp when they hear that. The kids are smart. The kids are open-minded. If you get a chance to talk to them outside of a protest, and when you speak the truth, they actually listen and they learn something. It doesn't mean they always agree with you, but they're open to it. And so that cannot be tolerated at these institutions. So they turn these kids into little self-enforcing brown shirts for what the administration and the teachers believe.
Yeah. You know, I think you just made such a great point, Mark, and it's relevant for anyone who's a parent or a grandparent or aunt or uncle. And that is how critical it is that we, in an age where, you know, most kids go to public school, they're trained by the public school system, which has really taken out training toward goodness and toward character and toward virtue and what is right. So we now more than ever need to make it a top priority that we are training our kids to love what is good and true and beautiful. And as I think about it, I think that's really the best thing that we can do to prepare our young people to go into these college environments and to be a source of light, to be, you know, truth speakers and peacemakers at the same time.
Yeah, look, I think every human being needs a mission. We need something that we're willing to fight and die for in our lives. And if you raise your kids without that mission, I think human beings desire that. We need that, especially, I would say, young men are always looking for a quest. Men look for quests generally, and this is just the nature of mankind. And the question is, what's your quest? What do you instill in your kids that they're supposed to do when they go out there in the world? And again, I'm not talking about what's their career, stuff like that. What are their interests? I'm talking about as a human being, what are they out there standing for? And every human wants to feel like they're standing for something. So if you don't help your kids to understand what's right and good and true and beautiful that they're supposed to be out there standing and fighting for, they will find something to stand and fight for. And if you're not careful about it, they might be standing with the terrorists.
Yeah. Mark, we're all out of time, and I think that's a great note to end on. Thanks for your insight today and being with me again for the program.
It's always a pleasure. And I just want to thank our listeners and our viewers. We have so much respect for you. And sometimes we dive into difficult and nuanced topics because we believe that you can handle the difficulty, that you're capable of understanding the nuance. And so we're not going to treat you like the standard news media. We're going to sit down with you guys like adults and have the difficult conversations. We thank you guys for responding positively to that.
Amen to that. And I want to also thank our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, Wishing Well Florists and Travel Services, and our friends at New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren in Harrisonburg. Thanks everyone for listening. And if you'd like to make a donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, Virginia 22803. I'm Rita Peters with Mark Meckler, inviting you to join us again next week for Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.
Thank you for listening to the Crossroads podcast. To learn more about Convention of States, go to conventionofstates.com.